to speak, and then we can have questions and answers afterwards about mental formations, working with mental formations in terms of the practice of mindfulness. As most of you know, these past 3 months, the community has been involved with looking deeply into mindfulness. And using, and even though we call ourselves the community of mindfulness and mindfulness practices of all types, so what we do, we wanted to kind of, you know, return to the fundamentals. And we've been using this original teaching of the Buddha called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is, again, one of the earliest teachings purported to be given by the Buddha and really dealt quite extensively with the practice of mindfulness. And as many of you know now, who can come here regularly, the practice of mindfulness involves not only becoming mindful of physical things, such as one's body and the sensations in the body, and of the senses and the sense objects as things we see and hear and smell and taste and feel, the whole, we could say, physical universe that we know through the senses. And learning that our capacity as human beings to be present to this very intrinsic part of what it means to be human is necessary for us to be fully human. And that often this really wondrous aspect of what it means to be human, and really a very essential way that we touch life. We touch life through our body and through our senses. We see each other, we see beauty, we see sundowns, we see beautiful things, we see ugly things, so-called. In the same way, the ears, the hearing reveals the sounds, and smells, and tastes, and etc. So the practice of mindfulness of the body is very important. For our return to our basic humaneness. Also within the context of mindfulness of the body, there is the mindfulness of the breath. Well, the breath is actually, of course, something the body does. It's a body function, a body process. But early on, the Buddha highly recommended it for a focus of attention. Believing that because the breath is always with us, as long as we're alive, we are breathing, and because it has a rhythmic nature to us, there is an in and out that is very observable, easily observable to anyone who attends to it, that mindfulness of the breath is a wonderful practice or just way of living that gives one a grounding, an anchor, in the midst of all the types of experience, because it is always occurring, and as well as because of its rhythmic nature, it is calming in and of itself. So it is an anchor, it is a grounding, but in and of itself it calms and quiets the mind. So mindfulness of the body and the breath is the foundation. But then the next three mindfulnesses, the foundations of mindfulness, has to do with the mind. The mindfulness, as you've learned probably in the past month, of what's called vedana in Sanskrit, often translated as feelings, but it means this very subtle movement of the mind where it moves towards things that it perceives as pleasant, away from things that it perceives as unpleasant, and is indifferent or neutral to those things that it thinks are neither. And this is the very kind of conditioned aspect of life. It is not involved in thought or perception or elaboration. It's just that unconscious, every time we have an experience, every time we have a physical experience or a mental experience, we don't even know it, but there is this immediate kind of vedana, which is, and we say pleasant, unpleasant, positive, negative, those are just words for it, but it really means there is something about that engagement that we are willing, let's say, to dwell a little bit longer, or to prolong it. There's a movement toward, or there's a movement away from, or there's indifference. But then, so that's the second foundation that the Buddha says we have to be very aware of this, because a lot of our reactions and our movements in life, both physically and mentally, are conditioned by this very unconscious moving toward or away from people, situations, thoughts, feelings, sights, sounds, and the whole parameter, taste, the whole, I like this, I don't like this. And this is before much elaboration or grasping or anything goes on. There is this vedana, a very important psychological phenomena that is really very much overlooked in Western psychology. But then the third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the mind and the mind. And here the Buddha is really getting to the core, I think, of where the problem lies, and that is within our own minds. And here what the Buddha wants us to look at are these formations within the mind. In the mind, there are thoughts, obviously. Anybody who's meditated will see thoughts endlessly arising and passing away. There are thoughts which can be thoughts that are just simply labeling of something, but they can also be perceptions, kind of the way the mind perceives situations, people, etc. As well as there's a full range of emotionality, imagination is possible within the mind, imagining things, as well as memory and other things. So all these are kind of formations or things that occur in the mind. But more specifically, when the Buddhist psychologists and meditators talk about the mind and mental formation, they're referring to kind of mental experiences or mind states that are a little more complex. They may be made up of thoughts and perceptions, but there's also emotionality, there's history and experiences, there's a lot of stuff. And we all know what these kind of formations are. And they're positive and negative. But they are really the thing that conditions so much of our experience, these mental formations. And the Buddha began, and it was continued, in kind of categorizing these mental formations as things that are either positive or negative. And when they categorize these states, mind states, and these can be mind states such as angry mind state, angry, resentful mind states, or fearful, anxious mind states. These can be mind states such as a mind state of a distracted mind. These can be mind states of all kinds of mind states. Characterized as negative. And then all kind of mind states that are characterized as positive, loving kindness, open-heartedness, calmness, stability, openness. So there are also many characteristics of mind states that would be deemed positive. Now, they are positive and negative in terms of something bigger, which is if the purpose of spiritual practice is to develop this kind of awakened mind. This mind, this enlightened mind is what's being cultivated. Then all the mind states that are conducive to, right, supportive of that more awakened, enlightened mind would be considered positive. And all those mind states that are destructive of, or don't contribute to, or are non-supportive of, would be construed as negative. Can you see? So it's not, this positive and negative is not a moral choice. Right? It's not good versus bad. It really has to do with those types of mind states that support well-being, harmony, open-heartedness, all that enlightened we could say, mind states, and all those that sabotage or are inimical to those positive ones. Is that clear? So that's what's your concern. So the question for those of us who have attained some degree of mindfulness, groundedness, clarity of mind, that one can actually look at one's mind, which is not all that difficult, but it demands a certain level of stability and clarity that we can turn the flashlight of mindfulness, the light of awareness, onto our own minds and watch it. Right? Most of us do not watch it. Most of us are tossed around by it, tossed around by these mind states. We are the servants. We are the slave of thought, perceptions, emotions, our conditioning. But to be able to stop and to look and to begin to categorize these mind states that are rising, to even say, to stop and go, I am aware there's anxiety in me. Or I'm aware there's no anxiety in me. I'm aware that my mind is stressed. I am aware that my mind is relaxed. I'm aware that my mind is closed. I'm aware that my mind is open. Right? So the capacity to just stop and turns one awareness on one's own mind and actually see what's going on and name it is the beginning. Right? The beginning of what? The beginning of healing and transformation, which is what this is all about. As I said in our Day of Mindfulness yesterday, our practice of mindfulness, our practice of the four foundations of mindfulness, is not to become expert mindfulnessers, expert mindfulness meditators. Right? Our practice of mindfulness is to facilitate the healing and transformation of our body minds so that we can lead happy, joyous, meaningful, open-hearted, etc. lives. Is that clear? And so, you know, the practices of mindful living at this deeper level is really about a transformative journey. We begin where we are. We take a clear inventory of our minds and its mind states over time. So we know them. We know ourselves. So many people say, I want to know myself. That's really what I want. I want to know who and what I am. Right? Sounds like a good thing. Mindfulness will reveal who and what we are because it turns on the light. And when you have the light on, we no longer have to imagine who we are. We don't have to think about who we are. Right? We don't have to project all kinds of stories from the past and the present or in the anticipation of the future about who and what we are. When we turn the light on, we will see who we are. And that that capacity to clearly see who we are by really watching our mind and really accepting unconditionally the mind states that are present within us is where we begin. But because this mind has had so little help along the way, because we have had so little support, coaching, counseling, training in how to really understand and to use our mind in an effective, meaningful way, along the way of this life, the stuff of our mind the formations within our mind have developed in all kinds of ways. And most of them are unsought by ourselves, just conditioned by experiences, by situations, by environments, by proclivities. And so when we take a unjaundiced, objective look at our minds, to see the mind states, we see. What we see, the good and the bad, we might say. We might see there are times when I am relaxed and my mind is open, my mind is peaceful, I am calm. There are times when my mind is free of affliction and it's even happy. There are times when my mind is kind, is altruistic, concerned about others. You know what I'm saying? So there are many times as we watch our mind throughout the day and over weeks and months, we notice there are many good mind states that arise within us. At the same time, we may notice that there are other types of formations. We may notice that there is time to time or fairly consistently anger, irritation, resentment, or anxiety, worry, fear, or sadness, despair, depression, or jealousy, or envy, or a tightness, stress, rigidity, closeness. You know, they're all different kinds of mind states. That we will discover very simply by turning on the light. You don't need a PhD in psychology. Right? One doesn't have to be an electrical engineer to turn on the light here. This is important that we don't make too big a deal about this. When I say we don't have to be an electrical engineer, we just know how to turn on the light. We know how to turn on the light because there are people like electrical engineers who know about things like generating electricity, that we don't have to do the work. We just can just turn on. We just have to know there's a switch and that the electricity is available and the light will turn on. Everybody in here has mindfulness as a capacity of their mind. It is a gift that was given to us. Along with our bodies, we were given a mind. And this mind is aware. And this awareness can be focused on something. Right? So, you know, we're already hard or soft-wired, whatever the expression would be, for awareness and mindfulness. What the teaching does is it shows us there is a switch. And how to turn it on, and how to direct it. Now we're directing it toward our mind. And we see that we have these various mind states. Now, if we're more than just, doing this for a research project, just to note all the various mind states and note them down, but we are doing this because we are in the process of healing and transformation, the next question begins, well, you know, how do I work with these? How do I work with these mind states? And again, I would begin to talk to you tonight about ways to work with mental formations. Now again, there are all types of mental formations. Some of them, we might say, are fairly innocuous, small, likes, dislikes, various kinds of proclivities of the mind that we've developed over time that aren't of great significance. And yet at the same time, there are others that are deep. Deep, in a sense, they relate to experiences. Either big experiences or lots of little experiences over time that have really shaped or conditioned our mind so that the way we see ourselves see others, see life, or respond to certain specific situations or general situations is always being conditioned by these mind states. Now, as I'm talking, I hope everybody is kind of referring to themselves to understand what we're talking about. So we have these formations in us. Now, the question is, how do you work with them? Well, I would say one way is when they arise. Right? So during the course of a day, of a week, many of these more afflictive mind states, these mind states that may have a lot of juice in them because of conditioning that may go back many years. The original woundings or the original issues or situations might have been years ago, but because we have lived by them for all the years of our life, they have been reinforced and reconditioned over and over again. So they have lots of history to support their validity, for us to continue to live by them, even though the antecedents may be years and years ago. So they come up. You're going about your life, and all of a sudden there's anger. You're going about your life, and all of a sudden there's hurt, disappointment. You're going upon your life, and there's a lot of fear or anxiety. You know, all this kind of stuff. Sometimes it's triggered off very clearly by situations. Sometimes it seems to have a life of its own. But otherwise, it has arisen. It is in our, if we are mindful, we can say, I am aware that such and such a mind state is present in me. Is everybody with me? You know, so you are now no longer just reacting from these mind states, which all it does is just continue the cycle. You're no longer reacting, but you're actually able to see and name it. I'm aware that suffering, that I'm suffering in this moment. I'm aware that I'm angry, I'm hurt, I'm disappointed. I'm lonely. You see, right? I'm aware, and I'm naming it. And now this is where it gets a little tricky, okay? Because usually, what is maintaining that emotion is the story. Everybody know the story? Right? And, you know, there's a story, and the story may begin with a story about what's going on right now, but often is supported by years and years of similar stories. All going to justify what? How I'm feeling, right? That my view of things is correct. And I have a good, and I am justified in being angry, scared, anxious, sad, despairing, you know, whatever the deal is, the story is reinforcing it. Everybody know what I mean? I mean, you have your own stuff in mind, but you see there's a commonality to it all. So in this practice, you have to do something that you're not used to doing. Rather than continuing to focus and reinforce the story, which will only just continue and intensify the emotion, which only just keeps that mental formation as big and solid and real as ever, we switch off the story and we just focus on the emotion. Because the story, you'll always have a story to justify what you're feeling. Is that clear? That is the nature of the self-mind. It always justifies itself and rationalizes itself. The problem is that the And what's most salient to us is if we can identify, it's very clear. I may think I'm very justified in thinking what I'm thinking, but if I stop for a moment and am present to what it feels like to be angry, I cannot help but notice that it is a mental formation that is causing me to suffer. That an angry mind state is a closed mind state, is a disturbed mind state, is an afflictive mind state. And it is diametrically opposite to the way I say I want to be. How do I want to be? What kind of person do I want to be? What? Happy, peaceful, open-hearted, loving, right? We all say that. But if I am present to the emotion, I can't help but notice the emotion that is being generated, that I am generating by my story, is diametrically opposite to how I say I want to be. So we hold the emotion in mindfulness and awareness, and we what? We calm it. We calm it. We take care of it. We hold it in mindfulness. We don't act. We don't react. We acknowledge that the anger belongs to who? To me. Right? 5 minutes ago, I was pinning it on you. I'm angry because of you, what you did or what you didn't, what you said or what you didn't say. But if I hold that feeling and emotion in mindfulness, I cannot help but notice that that emotion is arising only in me. It is mine. And it's my job to take care of it and calm it. When it has been calmed, then I can look into it. What is the source of this emotion? And there are many ways of looking at the source. We can talk about that. People look at the source as a psychological source. You can see the pattern going back to childhood or whatever, the wounding, or directed to the part of you that is wounded. But a lot of times it's based on misperceptions, based on egoism. So one way to deal with mental formations is to deal with them when they arise through mindfulness. Is that clear? There is another way that mindfulness can handle, which is you don't have to wait. This is very important. You don't have to wait. Many of us kind of know what our issues are, right? We know what our issues are. You know, we've done enough self-awareness. We have enough self-awareness. We've talked to people about our stuff. Our childhood, you know, we've been in therapy, we've been in all kinds of stuff. But many of us kind of, you know what our issues are, right? We know what our woundings are. We know what our triggers are. You know these words that I'm using? I mean, we talk this way to each other, right? So if there is that kind of self-awareness, you don't have to wait to be ambushed. You can bring these mind states up at times when there's no external trigger at all. You bring the mind state up and you use your mindfulness and your capacity to look deeply to investigate it, to heal it. There are parts of us that are wounded that need understanding, another way of looking at. Many of us, a lot of these stories we carry from childhood, in other words, about what he did to me or she didn't do to me, or how my childhood was or how my childhood wasn't, or who should have done what, or how I should have been, or what I should have done, or what I'm to blame for, or what they're to blame for. Everybody know what I'm talking about? All that stuff. You know, we finally need to just look at it. And if, you know, some stuff needs understanding, some things need compassion, but, you know, the parts in us that need to be, you know, if we have woundings in us, they need to be healed. It's as simple as that. And once I know that I have a deep gash in my arm, I no longer have an excuse for walking around for another 10 or 15 years with a deep gash in my arm. Once it's been brought to my attention that I have a deep gash in my arm and it's a source of why my arm hurts, then it's up to me to what? Mary, what's it up to you? It's up to me to take care of it. Right? Take care of it doesn't mean I just put a little piece of gauze over it. Putting a piece of gauze over it doesn't mean that I've really taken care of it. That I've really washed it and cleaned it, and I put on some triple antibiotic cream or whatever else it needs, or I've gotten it stitched, or, you know, I've taken real care of it so it can heal. You know, there are many of us in this room who have known what our issues are for years, know what our childhood woundings are for years. Know the source of our anger, the source of our hurt, the self of our self-hatred or judgments or critical, you know, all that stuff. We know what it is. And yet we continue year after year to carry it along, only contaminating our capacity to be happy human beings. So again, we don't have to wait. We can use our capacity to be mindful and present to bring this stuff up and to look deeply into it and to take care to heal those parts of ourselves that need to be healed. Is that clear? Well, then there is a third way. And again, these are all not like three different ways. These are three different ways that can be used at different times. The other way, which is very common, which is, we might say, the cultivation of positive mind states. Okay? Because when we are cultivating new types of positive mind states, we are sort of changing the mix of the mind and bringing in various kinds of energies that will have an effect on those parts of ourselves that are conditioned toward these negative formations. So therefore, the practice of meditation, the practice of mindfulness, you know, practices that bring some clarity, some openness, some calmness to the mind in general can have, you know, somewhat of a healing effect on these parts of our mind that are suffering, right? Cultivating compassion, cultivating loving kindness, cultivating patience, cultivating understanding. By cultivating these kinds of qualities of mind, that is also reconditioning the mind and also having an effect on these negative mental formations. Just to be mindful, just to be aware, can be significant game changer. Because a lot of times when one sees what's coming down the track, right, one can very easily maybe do something different. Just because one sees what's arising. sees there's some space to do something different. Before there wasn't any space. Right? The thing hits and it's just full blown in a minute. But a lot of times if the mind is clearer and calmer and more open in general now, that when these mind states, these traditional mind states are triggered, they're triggered in a very different environment. So the kind of positive reconditioning of the mind, the cultivation of a more positive mind, the cultivation of mind states as well as I say, kind of meditative states of clarity and openness and mindfulness and concentration and things like that, will also significantly impact the way these negative mental formations arise. Okay, there are other ways too, but let's just, any questions about this? This is because in talking to people, my sense is it's often not clear to people how to go about it. And this has got to be gone about. Okay? Because, you know, we can practice meditation and mindfulness and go on retreats and study and read. But if we don't take care of the healing and transformation of these types of mental formations that are so disturbing to the well-being and harmony of our mind and of the kind of spiritual aspirations that we want, you know, they will always be sabotaging, you know, how we want to be. So, questions? Come, yes. So, for example, let us say that you, and again, I don't know that well going to, so I'm just going to make this up. So let's say you notice, I don't know, you're very easily in situations, kind of oversensitive, you're easily hurt, let's say, you know, for whatever. And even though you've begun to practice mindfulness and get some clarity and have the capacity of kind of, when they arrive, just kind of seeing it and letting it go, over time you notice it keeps coming back. I mean, there's a trend here. There's a pattern, right? And so at this point, you know that this is not just a kind of situational, but there's something deeper. Okay? So rather than kind of dealing with it case by case, right, as the way we've been doing it up to now, you say, well, I need to look deeply into this, right? So you kind of, at a time when you're in a more reflective place, you bring up this mind state, right? Both the feeling of what that is like. You bring up, you remember a situation, you remember situations. So you bring it up, you bring up the feeling, and you're aware that this feeling and maybe the stories around it are very familiar. Right? And you may realize that even though times have changed, your age and situations have changed, this kind of underlying theme has been with you a long time. Okay. And so you want now to look deeply into it. Look deeply into it in Buddhism means causation. You know, what is supporting it? Not, you know, in Buddhism everything is sort of scientific, cause and effect. So if you're constantly having this effect in your life, you know there has to be a cause. It's not just, and so you'll be saying, there has to be a cause that's deeper than all these situations because it's coming from, you understand what I'm saying. So you look for some deeper kind of causes, okay? And let's say you find them. You find them, for example, in your childhood. A series, either one big interaction, you know, now that's called trauma, or just a whole series of interactions, or conditioning, the way you were raised, the family, and you can see how this unconditioned mind of a child was kind of conditioned in a certain way to see things himself or people or situations in a certain way that always brings up this response and how that has been carried through. Okay. Now, healing transformation. Right? if we let it stay and rest like that, it'll just continue. Right? So we need two things, healing to heal. As I said, we need understanding and compassion. Understanding is to now, to do something that you could not do in the situation, which was see it objectively or bigger picture. Because obviously when we're children, everything's very personal, right? Children, being children, are not very sophisticated in terms of interpreting events and placing causation in the right place. They tend to blame themselves and see the problem as them. They don't see the bigger picture. So with understanding, we have the capacity of really seeing more accurately now what really happened and what the causation was. And all that internalization of blame or about my own worthiness, lovability, unlovability, you know, all that stuff, we realize was based on misperception. And we can ascribe causation to really where it really was. But we can do it also without blame. Because even if we see the situation, we say, oh, this one or that one, we can almost understand that they were the product of causation. Something conditioned them. So we have a way of understanding that defangs, right, those the residue of unlovability, unworthiness, untrustworthy, you know, whatever it has been left that still activates us today. When I say compassion, I mean the capacity we have for feeling for those parts of ourselves, the wounding, right? And to acknowledge and to bring compassion, which is a place of connection, where in a certain way you embrace in a loving way that part of you that has stood outside alone for decades, bearing the same wound by itself, himself or herself, enshrouded in the same misperception or story that maintained that negative feeling. You now have the capacity of changing the story and not leaving that part of you alone. You bring them in. You bring them in through your willing to connect. How do you connect? We connect with compassion. We're willing to feel the suffering that we endured at that time and be open to it. No longer keep it out. You know, to heal means to become whole, right? To be whole means these parts of ourselves that exist in like separate universes of anger, resentment, hurt, loss, fear, self-worth, you know, all that stuff. It's like we have these fragments. And these fragments need to be brought together and made whole, so we can feel whole. If there are parts of us that are constantly open to wounding, even, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years later, that we are not whole yet. Right? It is through this wonderful gift we have to understand and to be compassionate. You know, how do we help another human being who's suffering? Right? How do we help another human being who's suffering? Somebody we care about. We say to them what? First of all, we're present to them. I am here with you. I accept you totally as you are. You don't have to pretend anything. Right? Tell me why you're suffering. Tell me about your suffering. And they tell us about their suffering. And we listen to them. we listen to them compassionately, don't we? We let them know we feel their suffering. And we want to help free them of their suffering. And one of the ways we do that is not only through our presence, but perhaps to tell them, perhaps the way they've interpreted a situation that leaves them with those negative emotions, perhaps is based on a misperception. You know, maybe there's another way of looking at this. You know, maybe a 5 or 7 year old's way of perceiving things may not always be, you know, most perceptive. Significant limitations. Many wonderful things about childhood, but there's some fundamental misperceptions. Besides, it's a time of incredible dependency. Critical thinking isn't well developed. Psychological insight isn't well developed. So lots of misperceptions, which lead to lots of emotional afflictions, which then just go on. Year after year after year after year, different decade, different people, same mind states. Why is that? Because we haven't stopped, turned on the light of mindfulness, and looked deeply. And then, you know, when we've seen the parts of ourselves that are wounded, that are skewed, that are causing these affliction mind states to arise in us, we are not giving them the care they need so they can heal. We are much better taking care of our body than we are in taking care of our minds. And we do not realize that in the same way, if our bodies are giving the right kind of care, they can heal. Right? They can heal from quite significant trauma. Bodies can, can't they? Yeah, bodies can be completely mangled up. Be riddled with all kinds of horrible diseases, and yet they can be healed. And the person can feel good again, can't they? Well, the mind can too. The mind has a great capacity of healing. But we don't know how to, up to now we haven't known that it does, and we haven't had the tools. But the tools are available to you. And you don't, again, need a PhD in psychology or 25 years of psychotherapy to accomplish it. But you do need the light turned on. And you do need a desire to heal and transform. And a willingness to be open to yourself. And to look deeply to yourself. Any other questions about dealing with mental formations? Yes. No, but what I'm saying, Bart, and let me just say for the record, so Bart's saying, hey, you know, I hear you, Fred, but, you know, sometimes it's hard to do by yourself, and outside help, therapy, other kinds of modalities, you know, that's needed. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, when I went through this whole system, I did not imply, I was talking about a process. And whether that process is a process that you can undertake yourself, or whether that process is benefited by having another person or a group of people facilitate that. Yeah, that's... Yeah, but either way, right? Either way, it can be done, and it needs to be done. We do not have to walk around with gaping wounds year after year. That's all I'm saying. So I'm glad you clarified that, but I'm not implying that, you know, this is something that we can all undertake alone. Right, which you know, again, being done with it is—it's not like you have to be done with it, because sometimes it takes time for it to play out. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh has a wonderful example where he says, you know, if you're going 5 miles an hour in your car and you put on your brakes, you'll stop pretty quickly. On the other hand, if you're going 100 miles an hour and you apply your brake in your car, it's going to be, you know, the braking distance is going to be much longer. Right? And I think in a certain way, you know, is what you're saying. You know, a lot of it depends on how deep and how fast we've been traveling with our woundings, right? And how quick, you know, some will end quicker, and some will take longer to end because there's more energy behind them. But the bottom line is, if you want to stop your car, you've got to keep the brake on. Right? If you apply the brake, you know, for 10 seconds, and then take your foot off the brake, right, you'll stop braking. And if you put your foot on the gas, even for a few minutes, you may find yourself back up at the same speed again. And then you apply the brake. Right? And then you take your foot off the brake. And then it picks up. You see what I'm saying? And that's, which is a very different than just saying, I'm applying the brake. Right? Consistently. Because I want it to stop. We have to want it to stop. And we have to believe there's a way that it could be stopped. Again, when Buddhist meditators and psychologists look at the mind, they don't see a permanent thing. They see mind states, and mind states that have causes, and mind states that are maintained by repetition over time that supports and maintains these mind states. Both the storylines and the dramas and the melodramas and the emotions. Right? It's not fixed. Right? Nobody came into this life with their issues. Does anybody remember at birth having an issue? No, you don't have issues. Issues are something that we develop over time in life, in situations. It's important to remember that, because many people say, well, this is all, you know, this is the way I am. Right? This is the way I am. That's nonsense. You weren't born that way. You weren't a child that way. But things happened along the way. And in this intersection of situations and personality and genetics, you know, this thing developed. And if you start changing the mix and start changing the influences, it'll change. We know even in medical science, right, that people even, you know, people have genetic makeups, things they've inherited from their families. But again, we know that if you introduce other variables, right, diet, exercise, mind state, you know, that even if one has a genetic predisposition, it doesn't have to flower, does it? I mean, we know that in medicine. Same way for the mind. So just because you've been conditioned, you know, just the idea that it's been conditioned should give you a clue to go, oh, then I can uncondition it, or I can recondition it. Let's go back to Gunther. Gunther says, yeah, my stuff comes up, right? But I've learned enough in the last couple of years that if I kind of look at it in mindfulness and hold it and don't, you know, keep it going, it, what happens? It disappears. Well, what does that tell you about the substance of mind states? Are they solid, permanent things? No. If they were solid, permanent things, they would just stay there. The same. Fixed over time. No, they come and they go. They come and they go. They have no root. No solid root. So that is why you can just look at, hold in mindfulness, you know, a thought or a feeling, and it will just dissipate. Because the mindfulness reveals the nature of thoughts and feelings and perceptions. They are not fixed, permanent, rooted entities. They float. They float to mind. They float to our awareness. They come and they go. But because we don't see that, and because we don't know that, we are entranced by them. We identify with them. Right? As Randy said in the beginning, liberate me from the inferiority, superiority, inequality complex. This is saying what? That the way I view myself, whether I view myself superior to, inferior to, or equal to everybody else, these are just self-generated mind states. They have no reality other than my own mental fabrication. That's the truth. Yes, Maria. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, so you're saying you'd like a day of mindfulness just devoted to that.
Yeah.
I hear you, but if I can understand, you feel that like doing that on your own is too difficult? Or you don't understand how to do it? Which are you saying? That to have a container of other people around and some guidance would make it easier, or you don't understand it, and so therefore hard to do it on your own, or which are you saying? So like a retreat that really focused on this kind of self-healing. Like that you're saying. Okay. But please experiment. Experiment with maybe a less intense one to get some practice. But again, you know, I mean, I hear you, and that's good. But we do, over time, want to learn to trust ourselves. And to learn that we do have this capacity to be present to ourselves, the parts we like, and the parts we somehow learn not to like, the parts we accept, but the parts we reject. You know, we want to get beyond this. You know, and the mindfulness of the body, and the grounding, and the mindfulness of the body and the breath. Gives us often a ground, Maria, to then enter the mind. See, I think that you haven't heard that because I've been very involved with a group of people in the intensive, but I've said several times, I think there is a wisdom, this is my own two cents, that in the Buddha's presentation of the four foundations of mindfulness, he begins with mindfulness of the body and the breath. Because I think that's a grounding. You know, that's the grounding. Right. That's where the calming is, and that's where we kind of come home, where we have a place where we feel at home within ourselves. We come home and we feel comfortable and safe in our bodies and in our breath. And from that place, we can then venture into the mind. First, just categorizing what's there. You know, if you read the sutra, the various mind states. And then, moving into this work of healing and transformation. So it's not something you just jump into. Okay, so you kind of, so I'm glad we're having this discussion. It's, you know, first you want this grounding. And I thought in the beginning, that's where I began, was going over again mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath. So there is this place that we can connect with ourselves. It feels solid, stable, consistent. You know, breath is always with us. So if things get a little scary or things get a little, just come back. But again, otherwise, good. We can do it within retreat or days of mindfulness. Like Bart said, you know, therapeutic relationships of all types, mentorship relationships can also be helpful too. Yes. All right, and just to repeat, I mean, I think you spoke, which again, it's bizarre in this so intelligent society. There is so much understanding about how to take care of a body. We are so bodily focused. I mean, we spend hours exercising, you know, ad nauseum, get enough sleep, you're eating right, you know, supplements, vitamins, you know, it's like endless, right? And yet, with our minds, it's like, you know, it's freewheeling. Right? I mean, it's, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I think what we're talking about in these traditions, like the Buddhist traditions, you know, 2,600 years of how to take care of your mind, how to take care of your mental life, your emotional life, your relationship life, in a very way that we seem to be very clear about, at least people who care about their health and are somewhat motivated to be responsible for taking care of themselves and understand, you know, that we don't just have to be a slave to every illness that comes our way, that we can be proactive in how we take care of our bodies. In the same way, I think the Buddhist path is a way of how to take care of the mind, both to keep it healthy, but also how to take care of it when it is unhealthy, when it's afflicted. Again, that's a big one for us, because we grow up in a society that pays almost no attention to the well-being of the mind other than when it breaks down. You know? Right, but again, I understand, and that's, again, the therapeutic model in our society is a role where we can find professional help, find somebody to establish that role for us. But in terms of the path that we're talking about, how do you establish that in yourself? Again, what you just said, right? When there's a pain there, you say to yourself, I am aware that my knee hurts. There is a sense that there is something larger aware that part of the body is hurting, and there's also an awareness, hopefully, I need to do something, right? What we don't have, but what mindfulness will give us, is that same, again, you know, rather than just spewing forth with our hurt, our anger, our afflictions, our fears, to stop and say, just like you said, I am aware that there is anxiety or fear in my mind. That is, in the same way, kind of acknowledging there is pain in my knee. That's the beginning. And that has to happen. There has to be a part of us that has mindfulness or awareness and that can shine on the parts that are wounded and acknowledge it. There, in that, it's not really distance, it's a connection, but it's a way of separation enough that you can, right? You know, that you're not just a hurting knee, you're also somebody who knows the knee is hurting and can begin to, you know, at least say to herself, I better just sit down and take my weight off this. Right, or to do something, you know what I mean? But, yeah. But if there's nobody home to do that, and you just keep walking, It's just going to make it worse. Huh? And if there's nobody home that says, I'm aware there's anger, hurt, anxiety, fear, sadness, despair, whatever in me, and that it's an afflictive state, and I need to stop, be present to it, you know, and do something. But it's the same. We just need to learn to have that same caretaking relationship with our mind and our mind states that we do have with our body. Well, that's called practice. That's what we're learning. Right? We can learn it. We have good support. We have good teachers and teaching and community. And, right? Yes, Mary. Last one. Yeah. So, variations on a theme. But the important thing is that we understand that transformation is healing is always available to us, and that these mind states, even the ones that have seemed to be have been with us so long, we think they're normal and natural, and we think they're us, are not. We are essentially Buddhas, and we have the capacity of healing all our wounds and being free, happy beings. That is the message. That has been transmitted to us by past generations. So thank you. We'll stop for now.